Now we're turning this morning to Exodus chapter 20 and reading from verse 22. We're coming to a section which is called the Book of the Covenant, following on after the giving of the Ten Commandments. So let's read from Exodus chapter 20, beginning at verse 22. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Tell the Israelites this: You have seen for yourselves that I have spoken to you from heaven. Do not make any gods to be alongside me. Do not make for yourselves gods of silver or gods of gold. Make an altar of earth for me and sacrifice on it your burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, your sheep and goats and your cattle. Wherever I cause my name to be honored, I will come to you and bless you. If you make an altar of stones for me, do not build it with dressed stones, for you will defile it if you use a tool on it. And do not go up to my altar on steps, lest your nakedness be exposed on it. These are the laws you are to set before them. If you buy a Hebrew servant, he is to serve you for 6 years, but in the seventh year he shall go free without paying anything. If he comes alone, he is to go free alone, but if he has a wife when he comes, she is to go with him. If his master gives him a wife and she bears him sons or daughters, the woman and her children shall belong to her master, and only the man shall go free. But if the servant declares, 'I love my master and my wife and children, and do not want to go free,' then this master must take him before the judges. He shall take him to the door or the doorpost and pierce his ear with an awl. Then he will be his servant for life. If a man sells his daughter as a servant, she is not to go free as men servants do. If she does not please the master who has selected her for himself, he must let her be redeemed. He has no right to sell her to foreigners because he has broken faith with her. If he selects her for his son, he must grant her the full rights of a daughter. If he marries another woman, he must not deprive the first one of her food and clothing and marital rights. If he does not provide her with these three things, she is to go free without any payment of money." The Book of the Covenant goes on then to refer to personal injuries, protection of property, social responsibility, laws of justice and mercy, Sabbath laws, and finally, three annual festivals. But we're going to end the reading of God's word there this morning. As people of faith, we are sometimes accused of looking at the world through rose-colored glasses. We've an unrealistic view of the world. Take the Ten Commandments, for example. Aren't these completely unrealistic ideals? You could leave on the last couple of Sunday mornings saying it's all very good to talk about loving God and loving others, about respect for authority, honesty, respecting God's name, adultery and lust, hatred and murder, stealing and greed. But I live in the real world. What does love for God and love for others look like on a Monday morning? Well, that's what these chapters are all about. I must warn you that they're not the most exciting chapters in the Bible. In fact, one writer says that at this point in Exodus, boredom sets in, only to be relieved by the golden calf incident of chapter 32. But there's a reason we find these chapters dull and boring. It's because they are dull and boring. They're about ordinary, everyday life, and that's the point. The Book of the Covenant, these chapters are to help us understand what the Ten Commandments look like in our everyday lives. Philip Ryken writes, "The Book of the Covenant is about living for God, not just when we're standing at the foot of a mountain and gazing at his awesome glory, but when our neighbour borrows a DVD and fails to give it back, when someone is spreading rumours, or when an argument turns into a fist fight. In other words, it's about real life." So what does faith in the real world look like? What difference does it make? Well, in the real world, people use other people. You might say, when I go to work on Monday morning, my employer isn't concerned about me. They just want me to get my job done. They want me to work longer than I'm paid for and to do more than I'm supposed to. In the real world, people use other people. The ancient world was no different. People used other people. Israel had been slaves in Egypt, powerful nations, subjected nations, defeated in battle to slavery. And when we see slaves mentioned here, perhaps you're thinking of that kind of thing. When we see the word slave, we immediately think of the African slave trade and of another generation. Is God condoning slavery? Is God encouraging people to use other people? In the real world, People might use other people, but in Israel, servitude was to be voluntary. The slave trade as we know it was completely prohibited. Look at chapter 21, verse 16. Anyone who kidnaps another and either sells him or still has him when he is caught must be put to death. Involuntary servitude was punishable by death. So why would anyone willingly become a slave? Well, we're talking about a time without social welfare. If someone found themselves in dire poverty, they might voluntarily become someone's slave, where they would be provided with shelter, clothing and food in exchange for their labour. We read here as well about a parent selling their daughter as a servant. Why would someone do such a thing? It was because the daughter had no prospects so long as she remained in their household. They would give the daughter to serve someone else in the hopes of her having a better future. In fact, here there is the possibility of the girl marrying into the owner's family and no longer being treated as a servant, but as a daughter. In Israel, servitude was not only voluntary, it was also temporary. The maximum time that someone was to serve another was for 6 years. After that, the servant was free to leave. However, at that point, a servant may decide that he was having life pretty good where he was, that his master was a kind man and that he wanted to remain in his service. And the law provided opportunity for the servant to commit himself to lifelong service of his master. But again, this could only happen voluntarily. In Israel, servitude was not only voluntary and temporary, it was also supposed to be restorative. According to later laws in Deuteronomy, chapter 15, verse 12, when a servant was freed after 6 years, he was not to leave empty-handed. The master was to provide him with what he would need to begin to make a new life and a future for himself. In other words, it wasn't about getting everything you possibly could out of your servants, squeezing them dry until they had nothing left to give. It was about providing, training and releasing them to make a future for themselves. That's what loving others looks like in the real world. Working for the good of others rather than simply looking out for number one. The people of God were not to use other people as others might. They had known what it was to be slaves, to be mistreated, and if they were to have slaves, it must be for the good of the slave, to better their conditions, to give them a hope and a future. Instead of using others as the people of God are to reflect the character of the God whom we serve, seeking the good of others rather than our own good only. In the real world, people hurt other people. That's what happens when people only think of themselves and not others. It's a harsh reality of living in a fallen, sinful world, but just because the law forbids something like murder, it doesn't prevent murder from happening. And the laws of Israel reflected that. Sometimes people hurt others intentionally. They wanted to hurt another person. Sometimes unintentionally, they caused greater harm than they intended. Sometimes accidentally, the person just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. We can even hurt other people neglectfully. That is, they are injured not because of something we have done, but because of our neglect to do something that we ought to have done. Now, in most law codes of the time, there was no distinction between any of these things. It was a revenge culture, and if harm was done to a family member, the family were expected to avenge the harmed person. These laws sought to set limits upon that desire for revenge. Chapter 21, verse 23, life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. In the real world, people do hurt other people, but in Israel, where possible, restoration was necessary. People had to take responsibility for their actions, whether harm to others was done intentionally, unintentionally, accidentally, or neglectfully. Maybe you didn't mean it, maybe you hadn't intended it, but when harm is done to another person, we must take responsibility for our actions and seek where possible to make restoration. That's what love for others looks like in the real world. The people of God weren't to behave as others might, trying to get away with whatever we can get away with. Where we have caused harm to another person, we should seek where possible to make restoration. We should acknowledge the wrong that we have done, seek the forgiveness of the person to whom we've done wrong, and make restoration where they have suffered loss. That's what love for others looks like in the real world. In the sections mentioned here in Exodus 21, it's focused mostly on personal injuries and loss of life. Human life was held in such high regard that the death penalty was considered the only just punishment for deliberate premeditated murder. The death penalty was not because human life was considered of little value, but precisely because it was considered of such great value. No one but God had the right to take life. As we're about to enter debate over the coming months about the Eighth Amendment in our Constitution, granting rights to the unborn, it's interesting here that the life of the unborn is specifically mentioned, chapter 21, verse 22. And the person whose actions resulted in the death of the not yet born was to be held accountable for the taking of that life. As the people of God, we are to place value on human life because we understand that all human beings are made in the image of God, that God alone gives life, and that God alone has the right to take life. In the real world, people steal from other people. The law cannot prevent it, but it can hold people responsible for doing it. And the people of God needed to realize that theft is not the only way in which we can steal from others. We steal from other people through carelessness. We borrow some books or DVDs and we fail to return them. We borrow someone's car and we damage it. We borrow someone's lawnmower and we break it. When we fail to return, replace or repair what we have taken, broken or damaged, we're effectively stealing from another person. We have not thought of them at all. We haven't had any regard for their property. Now, you can be sure that if they didn't return our stuff or broke our tools, we'd be upset about it. That's because we're only thinking of ourselves and not the other person. But love for other people means treating them as we would like to be treated. We're always concerned about justice when we're the one who's been harmed, but loving others means that we are considerate of those to whom we cause harm, and where possible, we seek to make things right. People also steal from others by deceit. We know that there is a problem with our car. We don't want to pour money into repairing it. But maybe we can cut our losses. We could sell it on without mentioning the problem that it has. We get the money that we want and our problem becomes someone else's problem. We're deceiving another person, effectively stealing from them. Money that they would not spend had they known the truth about what we were selling. In the real world, people steal from other people. But in Israel, property must be respected. Because that's what loving others looks like in the real world. The people of God should not behave as other people might, stealing from others by theft, carelessness or deceit. The people of God should reflect the truthfulness and the honesty of the God whom they serve. In the real world, people take advantage of other people. If we can get ahead at the expense of other people, so be it. We live in a world that largely accepts the theory of evolution, survival of the fittest. The weak get crushed and extinguished, the strong succeed and thrive. It's natural, therefore, to take advantage of the weak and the powerless. But in Israel, there was to be protection for certain groups of people. People who were in vulnerable positions and easy prey for those wanting to take advantage of them. For example, the young. The example given here in chapter 22, verse 16, is of a young woman who is seduced by a man. Maybe he makes promises to her of his love and devotion. Maybe he assures her that he intends to marry her and provide her with a future. Whatever the case, he has only one intention, to sleep with her and not to marry her. In the culture of the day, that leaves her in a very vulnerable position. She is unwanted as a bride and therefore likely to remain dependent on her parents to provide for her. So the man who seduced her to sleep with him is responsible to take her as his wife, making provision for her. If the father considers him an unsuitable husband, he must make financial restitution for the damage he has done to her future prospects. Either way, he couldn't just get what he wanted and move on without taking responsibility for his actions. The young, the vulnerable, had to be protected. Also, widows and orphans. Widows and orphans were among the most vulnerable in this society. They had little or no means of income. They were dependent upon the goodness of others, and they were most vulnerable to be taken advantage of. They would no one to take up their cause, no one to fight for them, except God himself. And God would not deal lightly with those who take advantage of the most vulnerable, threatening to take the lives of those who do so, and leaving their families as widows and orphans. Also, the needy, who were in such desperation that they would agree to loans at exorbitant interest rates. In fact, if someone loaned to the needy, they were to do so without any interest. Their concern was not to make money, but to help the person in need. And as for the foreigners living in the land, they were not to be mistreated or oppressed, but treated with respect. In Israel, there was to be justice and mercy. A justice and mercy that reflected the character of their God. They had been slaves in a foreign land. They knew what it was to be mistreated. They knew what it was to be vulnerable. And so they were to be considerate of others in that same position. The people of God were to reflect the character of God whom they served, a God of justice and mercy. The long and short of it is this. In the real world, people sin. People use other people. People hurt other people. People steal from other people. People take advantage of other people. People think of themselves and not others. People sin. So it should be no surprise that along with these laws, something else was included from the very beginning. Sacrifice. We all sin, and we are all in need of forgiveness. Part of the instructions that we read this morning related to the building of altars, altars on which sacrifice would be made, sacrifices because people failed to keep God's law and treat people as they should. None of us measures up to the Ten Commandments, not when we understand how they apply to all of life. We all stand guilty before God, condemned by his justice, and in need of his mercy. And the altar points to his mercy. An animal could die in the place of the sinner. Of course, the animal could not really take our place, but it pointed to one who would come, the Lamb of God, Jesus, who would take upon himself the sins of the world. And through his sacrifice, by trusting in him, we can receive the forgiveness of God. Yet this holy God desires for himself a holy people. This God of justice and mercy desires a people who will reflect his justice and mercy. And the only way we can ever love people in the way that we are meant to is if we gladly live under God's rule. If we have known the forgiveness of God, if we know that we have failed to live the way that we should also desire to live differently. We recognize that God's ways are best, even when the desires of our heart are pulling us in a different direction. And we want what is only good for ourselves. And so we commit ourselves to live under God's rule. I've added one more word to that statement. As God's people, we are not just to live under God's rule. We are to gladly live under God's rule. This section of the Book of the Covenant ends in chapter 23, verses 14 to 19, with instructions regarding three celebrations. The worship of God was not just a commitment to obey certain rules and regulations. It was a joyous celebration in the salvation of God and his continued care of his people. That's why they were to live differently. God had rescued and saved them, and God was with them. He had done the same for us in Jesus. He has rescued and saved us, granting us forgiveness in Jesus, and he is with us as we gladly live under his rule. Let's pray together.